I had enjoyed improv and I had enjoyed acting, but I had never really hooked into anything that had any momentum. And it just sort of felt like I could be the expert in this. So hey everyone, this is Kara Lee.
This is Daniel.
And this is the Actor Hack Podcast.
Coming to you from Brooklyn, New York.
And we have Lissa with us today.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for coming.
Oh, I love it.
When did you move to New York?
Well, I technically moved to New York about 10 and a half years ago. I have been in Astoria the whole time. However, my parents are both born and raised in Queens.
Okay.
And my grandparents are from New York as well. I was raised in Connecticut, but I never was okay with that. So I consider myself a New Yorker for life. I went to Northwestern. I'm just a perpetual student. So when I came to New York, I went back to school to Maggie Flanagan. I went through the Pitt Improv program. I just continued to take as much school as possible.
And what did you study at Northwestern?
Theater and English. It's not a conservatory program. We were encouraged to take other kinds of disciplines outside of that, but we did have acting class 4 days a week, and we also had, you know, a technical requirement, so for like scenic design or stage management, but they certainly encouraged many paths of study. I didn't feel super empowered about the business side of acting when I graduated because that just wasn't the focus at Northwestern, and so in order to be practical, I actually came to New York to get into publishing. I went to the Columbia Publishing course.
Mm-hmm.
I then had, over the next year, 28 interviews. Did not get a single one of those jobs. Ideally, I wanted to be an editorial, like be an editor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you start as an editorial assistant, but like the publishing world is shrinking rapidly, and the number of people who want to get into that is growing rapidly. So I realized actually at the publishing course, we had like a bunch of lecturers who were people in the business, and they were describing their day. And inside, I was thinking to myself, well, that's not as creative as I thought it was going to be. So
yeah.
Even when I took an internship at Broadway.com so I could just, like, work on something while I was waiting for a job, that whole time I was thinking to myself, I would rather be performing right now. And I knew that that was the truth, but I wasn't ready to accept it because I come from a really, I guess, traditional family, a traditional nuclear family, and I was expecting to just have, like, stability all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But then, you know, that falls apart in your 20s.
Right.
Yeah. And then on Playbill, there was an ad for a marketing and development assistant at Labyrinth Theater Company. I applied to that. First theater job I applied to, and I got it. So I said, this is a sign. It was it's an amazing company to work mm-hmm. for. I assisted both the marketing and development directors for 2 years until they had to disintegrate that position. And so I did a lot of help with event planning. They have a huge benefit, the Celebrity Charades benefit every year that I did a lot of work on. I did some graphic design. I created the playbills. I learned how to write press releases. I learned how to write grants. So while I was doing it, because I couldn't see the future, I was feeling frustrated because the company members would be coming and going in the office, and I was thinking to myself, I want to be doing what they're doing so badly. I don't just want to be the office girl. You know, lo and behold, those tools became extremely crucial for me. When they disintegrated my job, I collected unemployment for the full time that I possibly could, because it was in 2008, and so everybody was losing their job.
Yes.
So I collected unemployment, and that's when I started at Maggie Flanagan. So that's a 2-year program. The unemployment lasted for 2 years. The timing was kind of perfect. Many of the company members at Labyrinth had Maggie as their teacher. A lot of them went to the Mason Gross School at Rutgers, which is where Maggie and Esper came from. And so when I would talk to the company members when they'd come in and ask them who they recommended, they all just swore by Maggie, their guru. It was the best 2 years of my life. It was incredible. It was very challenging. And then the second year, you're there at the studio pretty much every day because it's not just the acting, it's the movement component, which I got extra involved in and studied to learn how to teach it, and the voice and the cold reading, the monologues, the script analysis. It's designed to break you all the way down, pretty much, so that you become an open and vulnerable instrument. And that was when I felt like I really learned how to act. For me, you know, it's not for everybody. The second year, there was a business class. It was helpful because I had never had any kind of business training before. People in a Meisner program sort of drink the Kool-Aid and begin to think that there's only one way of doing things, which I was also a victim of. Not a victim, that's a terrible way to say it. I drank the Kool-Aid because I wanted to drink the Kool-Aid, you know? I bought into it. The business class taught me a lot of skills, but it also taught me a lot of ways that I am not. And it was so stringent. I realized after the fact that I had been a little bit overtrained in it. Like, I could actually relax. We would have casting directors come in, and the teacher would tell us that we all had to be basically wearing hot, hot, hot black tie things and, like, heels and, like, all kinds of... I mean, it was not the kind of thing that I would ever wear into an audition now, but because that's what worked for her...
Yeah, that's totally misguided.
It was Heidi Griffiths who came in at one point. You know, she's from the public. Mm-hmm. She was like, why is everybody all dressed like this?
What's happening?
What's going
here?
On right now? We all look like we're going to a cocktail party.
Is this a slut school? Yes.
But I learned about, like, headshots and how to select a good photographer, what kind of, you know, monologues to bring in, although monologues now are kind of archaic, which I'm so delighted. Well, I had to figure out how to earn money because it was the first time in my life when I didn't have any kind of plan or structure. And so I figured I had to do what actors do, which is learn how to be in the food service industry. So I catered for a little while, and then I got my first restaurant serving job. And I pretty much focused on that because kind of an OCD type A person, and learning how to be a server is like a completely different set of skills in your brain and organizing things. And so I focused on that for a while before I got back into performing and going to one-on-one and taking classes at the Pit. They have a 5-level improv program, which is pretty standard in the city. You know, there's UCB and the Magnet and Annoyance too. And I actually just, I was at one-on-one, and I ran into a guy who I had done a play with, and he said, oh yeah, you were really funny, you should really take improv classes, you should go to the Pit. And I was like, random, okay, but I didn't know what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And the next day I signed up for level one at the Pit for the sake of having it on my resume for commercial purposes, because I really wanted to do that, and then I ended up falling down a hole.
Yeah.
Like, comedy was not the plan at all, and mm-hmm. I just got obsessed with it.
It sucks you in.
It does, and it's also, the Pit specifically is really all about community, less than some of the other schools, which focus more on, you know, on the game and on, like, hustling up to the top, but the Pit is very much community-based, and I needed a family.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what, if you go into the Pit now, there is a piece of paper above the box office that says, the path has brought you here for a reason. And I mean, my whole life has happened because of the Pit. I met my boyfriend of 3.5 years there, well, I guess 4 years next month. And, you know, some of my best friends from there, it was really just a fluke. I mean, I took classes at other places, too, then after, once I had finished, because you're just always hungry for more. The Pit is just, it allows for communication with teachers, it's very kind of open setting, there's more opportunities for stage time, as opposed to UCB, which is much, it's kind of like a bottleneck. Thousands of people who go through there, and very few of them get stage time.
I know at UCB, don't you have to, like, pass?
The Pit, you don't have to, which is kind of why you can be in level 5 and have some, like, real weird people in there with you, and you just have to kind of suck it up and deal. But it makes you a better improviser, so you don't have to be passed. Yeah, at UCB, I think it's once you get past level 3, you have to be passed into the advanced levels.
Okay.
But not so at the Pit or the Magnet. So I was at the Pit, I was improvising, and I was on a couple of indie teams, and then this one girl I knew had this random variety show in the underground space, and she said, you can bring whatever you want. I brought in some diary entries from the diaries I kept when I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the response they got just blew me away. People were, like, losing their shit and laughing so hard, and I was like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was so embarrassed to read it, and I had done the show Mortified once. It's more like a storytelling or stand-up show, in that, like, there's a host, and then there are 4 or 5 people who will get up on stage and read something from their youth. So it's not interactive. And once I had done this variety show at the Pit, I was like, how can I get other people to have this experience? Because for me, it was so redeeming to have people, strangers, come up to me afterward and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe you felt that way. I felt the same way. I you know, I thought I was alone. That is an addictive feeling to have, you know? And especially because of my training at Maggie's and with the Williamson movement technique, which is all about allowing yourself to become vulnerable, because that's how, I think that's how transformation happens, you know, outside of the acting world, like in life. And I'm kind of a woo-woo hippie spiritual person. So I had this idea to have a talk show format in which my guests would bring something that they made in their youth and would share it, and hopefully to the same effect, and like be nervous to do so, but then feel redeemed once they had done it. And it was like February 2014 was when it was scheduled for. And there was a new artistic director at the Pit at the time who I didn't know very well, I hadn't met. And I was in Miami with my friend taking a long weekend because I hate New York in the winter. And I was freaking out about the show. And I said, I don't want to do it. I don't know what's going to happen. I feel totally unprepared. Ah. And so I wrote to the artistic director and I said, hey, I want to cancel this show. And he was like, well, that's really not cool. because it was like a week before. He's like, that's really not cool, and we're going to have to charge you $350 for the space fee. And I was like, I don't have that. So I did the show.
No, the show. Yeah.
So I, but like, it's crazy how much resistance there was going into it. And then once the show happened, it was like, it just started rolling forward. I mean, it's already hard enough to put your most vulnerable self out there, and it's one thing to do it when somebody else is kind of producing and you have your 10 minutes and then you can like scurry away and disappear if it doesn't go well. But if it's your project that and it doesn't go well, it's hard to deal with that kind of failure because it's so personal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're like,
it's
vulnerable,
so
times 10.
Intimate.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I also, to be honest, like, I don't do very well with failure, and I like to be good at everything that I do. So I couldn't tolerate the idea of it being mediocre. I find that people who know about the show before their guests on it come on, like, ready to unleash. Like, yeah. I had a guest when I did the show in L.A. last month who, within the first 5 minutes of our interview, started talking about how her brother had committed suicide. Like, I didn't even know or ask for it. She just volunteered the information.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And so I think, especially with comedians, most of my guests end up being comedians. They're used to being on stage and embarrassing themselves on purpose all the time, but they're not actually vulnerable or embarrassed because they write their material first. They know what they're going to say. But I've had people come on who I've seen be on stage a million times suddenly turn red in the face and be like, oh my God, I'm kind of nervous to read this or sing this, or because it's unearthing things that were never meant to be seen by the public. But like, that's what's so precious about them. That's the gem, you know? And like, when you know in that moment, when you're on stage and people have that catch in their breath and they're like, oh, I don't know if I can do this. I'm like, yes, like, that's the gold. The first time you do any kind of a show, it has this novelty factor about it. Talk to me about 4 months in when nobody showed up. I had a show when not a single person showed up. It's one of the worst days of my life.
Oh, no.
What did you do? Like, did you just do the show? Just
we didn't do it because I had four guests come and, like, you know, we have to set up this whole PowerPoint so we can project all of their pictures, and we have the music cues and everything. And it was so embarrassing because it was like I had my birthday party and I was like all dressed up for it and nobody came.
Right.
And I had invited 1,000 people on Facebook. And so I cried for like 12 hours. I just didn't get off the floor. I think it was the fourth show. And then after that, I said, oh, I really don't want to give this up. I want to treat it like a legit thing. And that was when I wrote a press release and started reaching out to Time Out New York and the Village Voice and that kind of thing, and to make it like larger than just my community of people.
Right. But you would think, I mean, because you have guests coming on, like they're would bring their crowd as well?
Yeah.
It depends. I mean, usually yes. Mm-hmm. And especially for the first few shows I did, because the guests who I had on weren't like big names. They were just my peers. Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh, look how fun this is. I'm going to share this thing from, you know, high school. And it worked. But for whatever reason, like that show, it was a 7 o'clock on a Tuesday night. And at the Pit, I love the Pit. And the Pit is the reason I have this show. However, they do have like 12 different shows a night in that building, and they don't have a person who does PR or marketing on staff. Like, they have some interns who do like social media, but
you're responsible.
The producer is responsible for all of it. I just will never get tired of people having aha moments or epiphanies, and I want to facilitate that. And once I'd had the first show, I knew that I wanted to do it seriously or not at all. But I was so excited also to have this opportunity to decide, like, design this entire show myself. And, you know, I was never really good at group work when I was in school because I wanted to do it the way that I knew was best, and which is, you know, again, something we're working on. But I never really wanted to be a producer. I still don't really. I mean, I recognize that I might be well suited for it, but it's extremely stressful, and I really was just doing it as a platform to get me, to give me an excuse to be on stage, speaking my mind.
Right.
So, you know, as the show has grown and the producing aspects of it have gotten more intense, kind of over it, I love to do stand-up shows now because I can just, like, pop in and say my piece and then leave and not have to design the rest of it. So everybody has to learn to be a producer to an extent. It's overwhelming because there are so many ways to get that exposure now because of Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all the things. It didn't used to be available, so I'm trying to be thankful for it because it used to be in comedy. There was the club scene only where you had to get passed by the club owner and then maybe you'd get a slot. But now, because comedy has expanded so much in the indie world, anybody can produce whenever they want. But if you're not shouting
all the time about what you're doing, you kind of, like, get carried away by the current. Because Twitter is essentially a platform for one-liners, and everybody's shouting them all the time.
Right.
And it just moves by so quickly, and people's attention spans go so fast, you have to always be, like, reminding people, hey.
Do you feel like you're good at social media in that respect?
I feel like I'm good at it because I know how to write ad copy and that kind of thing, but is it good for me? No, not at all. It makes me crazy.
How did you come up with the name?
When I was younger, I guess I started when I was 6, I would take dance lessons and we would carpool with girls in the neighborhood. There were like 4 girls in the neighborhood that would drive together, and I was always the littlest one, so I had to sit in the middle seat in the back of the car. The bitch seat. So,
oh, nice. Is that why you have a tutu on in your picture?
Yep. Or is that... I'm sitting on the left, and my boyfriend is actually the co-host of the show now. Mm-hmm. Sits on the right, and then there's a middle seat where the guest will sit. So that's the bitch seat.
And has he always co-hosted with you?
No, he didn't start out co-hosting. He's always been incredibly supportive, and he has come to all the shows, and he helps me prepare the technical aspects of it. But one show I decided to kind of have him on as a guest star. We have a really, really good dynamic on stage
together. Yeah, and I think it's nice that you have someone to bounce off of, like, in between guests and just things like that.
It's great. And he offers things that I wouldn't have thought of, and he helps move conversations along if there's a dead spot, and he's the best. Once the artistic director had seen it that first time, we had a meeting about it, and he offered me a monthly run for 6 months, which I did, at the Pit. And it's a really great place to learn how to do it because there were always people around and everybody knows each other. It always had at least a couple of people trickling in who were just in the building anyway. So it was a safe space to grow it. And then once we had been there for about a year doing monthly shows, I started to get kind of antsy and frustrated because it was hard to pull in any new audience. And I felt like I was doing more PR work than maybe I would need to do at another venue. And I had had other actually lady friends of mine who had their own shows that they produce, Natalie Wall, who does Awkward Sex in the City, and Jamie Lilo, who does Brunch Night, they had moved out of the Pit and begun to book some bigger guests, and they were getting more press, and so they were recommending that I do that. So the last show I had at the Pit, I had Mike Kaplan on. He's a big comedian. He was actually on America's Got Talent recently, which is so crazy. That was sort of the launch point for... He opened the doors to other, like, bigger comedians who are more established in the world. We pitched to Union Hall, and they took us, which was huge. Because we did 3 shows at Union Hall. 2 of them were standing room only. There were, like, 75 people in the room.
That's
which was
awesome.
Insane. I mean, like, talk about... The highs are very high. To come out on stage for a show that you produce and see that many people there is just... Like, that's why I keep doing it, you know? And then we tried a couple of other places. We did it in a friend's apartment once where we live streamed it. And I had kind of been thinking about LA for, like, 3 years. And I like it. And a friend of mine had moved out recently and was an intern at the Nerd Melt Theater at Meltdown Comics, which I also followed on Instagram. So I saw, like, all of my heroes were there, you know, like Kumail Nanjiani and TJ Miller and, you know, all these people that I loved. So my friend started interning out there, and I asked him off the cuff, like, do you think this would be a good fit for us? And he hooked me up with the program director at the time, and I sent a formal pitch. And she said, yeah. When people ask me... Like, it's so funny. I feel like there are so many things that have happened where the show seems really successful from the outside. And it's got a lot of press and great guests and stuff. And people are like, wow, you're doing so great. Like, how did you do that? And I'm like, literally, I just asked. That's all you have to do. Be prepared when you ask.
Right.
If you have a well-composed blurb about what the show is. Like, and our show is very specific. It's very niche, which... Yeah. Places like, because they can sell that. I butter up whatever the venue is and say these are the specific reasons why this would be good for this show.
Right.
You know, we've been a Time Out Critics pick for X amount of time, and this and this, and if you'd like to see more press, you can see here. If you'd like to see what great past guests we've had, you can see here. And then I attach a couple of silly promo photos. It's like a packet in email form, but it's also, what's been successful for me is having a sort of crossbreed of formal and casual. Like, seeming like I'm not a psycho has been really important for booking guests especially. And so I'll say, like, oh, I got your email address from so-and-so, so that they don't think I'm a psycho. But for my LA shows, I really have been just cold pitching. My friend who is out there is my co-producer out there, and he's amazing. Mm-hmm. And he knows all, like, the Hollywood speak. And he's got friends who work at agencies who represent a lot of people. I take the pitch letter that I sent to the venue and kind of tweak it a little bit to tell, like, the guest what to be prepared for. And usually if they see X, Y, or Z other comedians have done it, they're like, oh, that's legit. Once you get the momentum for that. But it was crazy, because the first time I went to LA, I pitched to my heroes. I mean, I didn't get them, but I pitched to Marc Maron, mm-hmm. you know, and had, like, a real professional conversation with his agent about it, which was crazy. And, like, right now I'm in talks with Cameron Esposito for our next LA show, which is May 7th, and regardless of if it happens or not, that's insane.
Yeah, that's
I think that's amazing. I think your whole, like, just ask. Like, mm-hmm. just put yourself out there.
Well, yeah.
It's, like, amazing.
The first time we got printed in Time Out New York, it was before I even had a PR person. Now I hire a PR person to help me get the word out. But mm-hmm. before that, for months, I would just do it myself. And the first time we were in the printed Time Out New York, I had this moment of, like, oh, I'm really proud of this, but I did it all myself. Which was equally happy and also kind of a letdown, because part of the reason why I wanted to be an actor in the first place, and the reason why I think a lot of people get into performing, is because they want to be picked. They want to be the special one who somebody comes for and is like, I choose you, you know? And this was like, nobody chose me. I just forced myself upon the world, and they said yes, okay. But, like, it was less magical than I had
thought it would be.
I thought it would be.
I just think it's so badass to be like,
I think, I mean, yeah, I would have never thought of it in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take badass.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Definitely.
If you ask in such a way as to show whoever you're asking what the benefit to them would be, mm-hmm. that's the important part. Although I have to say, after doing the show for so long and marketing myself, you begin to feel a little like, ugh, like, I'm just so tired of selling myself, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? Because it's not just, hey, I'm in this show, come do it. It's like, I am this show, and my face is all over it, which is cool for a while. But then it's like, I'm so sorry, guys. I'm sick of me, too. Yeah. I'm sorry. This past year was my first festival experience. It was Cake Batter's Funny Women Festival at Iowa West. I did it as a stand-up. I'm a young stand-up. It kind of seemed like the natural progression, because if I try to hone down exactly what it is that I am, like, grabbing for when I pursue performing, it's really like there's nothing that tops being on stage as myself and speaking my truth in front of an audience full of strangers.
So then did you take any classes in stand-up, or...?
Yeah, I did take one. It was at the Broadway Comedy Club. And it was important for me to the extent that I met some other comics in the class who are now good friends of mine. It gave me the opportunity for the first time to feel what it was like to craft jokes and do them on stage. Do I think that people need to take stand-up classes? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Your best bet is to go to open mics. Just go to them and fail.
Just learn by doing.
A few years ago, I was talking to my friend who was on an indie improv team with me, and we were having this insane fight about poetry versus stand-up.
Because that sounds pretty heated.
It was very heated. It was in a noodle place in Koreatown, and he had started doing stand-up, but I was still, like, listen, I was real pretentious up until, maybe I still am, but, like, it's been an evolution, and I was like, ugh, I think stand-up is just, like, cheap, and you're just begging for attention, but, like, poetry is, like, because they're both about crafting words, really, like, honing it down to the bare bones. But I was like, poetry is just more beautiful and more truthful and more blah, 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 whatever. And then within a matter of years, mm-hmm. I had become a stand-up. I mean, the bitch seat really opened a lot of doors in terms of people, in terms of me having any kind of visibility. There are also these great groups on Facebook that are for women in comedy that have hundreds of people in them where everybody is networking and they say, you know, I have this show coming up, I need to fill a slot, whatever. And because of the class I took, I have a 5-minute tape, like of a 5-minute set that I did, that I can use to, like, pitch to people who have their own shows that they produce. So, yeah, I'm kind of at the point now where I can book shows just by networking with people. And there's a website called badslava.com, B-A-D-S-L-A-V-A, where there's a pretty comprehensive list of the mics happening in the city from day to day. Basically, you show up and there's usually, like, a bucket of some sort where you write your name and you put it in the bucket. Sometimes there's a fee, like a $1 to $4 fee to participate. And then there's a one or two hosts. usually who will come up between each performer and do a little bit themselves and then read off like four or five names of these are the people who are coming up next. And I think like average mics are about 4 minutes. You get 4 minutes of stage time and then you get a light at three and then another light at four, meaning you're done. But like there are mics that are 7 minutes and there are mics that are two. How many jokes can you say in 2 minutes?
I know, so 2 minutes is pathetic.
Ridiculous.
It's like speed dating.
It is, it is exactly like speed dating. And, I mean, depending, like, if you go to a mic and you feel really uncomfortable about the vibe in that room, you don't have to go back to that room. They're not all like that. There are some mics where everybody in there is, like, is either drunk or they're, like, they do not care. They're, like, apathetic. They're sitting in the back looking at their notes and they're not paying attention to you. But there are other rooms that are super warm and friendly, and so it's worth it to keep
trying different
ones. And the more of them you go to and the more you fall on your face, the better you are at dealing with that. Because, honestly, comedians are the most difficult audience. And it's a really, really fascinating time in comedy in New York and in L.A. right now because of the whole gender discussion. Because up until very, very, very recently, it was a very white male-dominated thing. And, like, I don't consider myself, I'm not, like, a bra-burning feminist, and I don't want all men to die because I think that that is divisive as opposed to uniting, which is more helpful. But there are now so many friendlier open mics because there are so many more people flooding into the comedy scene that whose voices have not been heard yet. Mm-hmm. So there are still many mics where it's all going to be like white dudes wearing tracksuits who don't give a shit. But there are also many, many mics that are women friendly or gay friendly or like themed, or there's just a huge
that's really cool
variety.
Does everyone get seen, or is it just a time allowance sort of situation?
I have yet to go to a mic where everybody does not get seen.
Okay, that's good.
That said, like, depending how many slots they have, like, 20 slots, you could be sitting there for 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
So, it's friendly to stay until the end, but frequently people don't.
Like, just the idea of, like, the light flashing to know that you have, like, a minute left
gives you a heart attack.
I'm like, if it was me, I would just be like, okay, I'm done. Thank you.
I know. Well, that's a really scary part. Like, it's actually, I've done, like, 10 or 15 minute sets before, and I find those so much easier than doing a 4 or 5 minute set, because you have to select your words so much more carefully, and mm-hmm. I already talk fast as it is. So, if I have, like, a 4 minute set, it's just, like, the Micro Machines guy the whole time. You get used to the light, though. The light actually becomes your friend, because then you don't have to think about that calculation.
Okay.
You can just focus on the work, mm-hmm. and then somebody else will take care of timing you. But it's hard to get used to it, especially right. if you've run over like the warning light and then you're at the final light and you're like halfway through a joke. Most of the times they won't pull the lights on you. But when I was at the Funny Women Fest, because the timing was so, everything was just so crunched, and there were so many people that needed to go, I did see a couple of girls who were super, super nervous. Bless their hearts. They got the first light, kept going, got the second light, kept going, and then they turned the mic off.
Oh my god.
And they kept going. This one girl kept talking, and I was like, no, you have to have it, like, awareness of the room.
Oh, where is the bitch seat at right now?
Well, we do have a podcast that we have, I think, 7 episodes out now. It's weekly. It comes out on Sundays. So you can do an iTunes search for The Bitch Seat. It's pretty similar format to the live show, except we do one guest at a time. So it's myself and Phil co-hosting, and then one guest, and I'll start the show out with a reading selection from a diary. And then we'll have one guest in the room with us who will share some artifact that they have. And then we'll talk for like 45 minutes or an hour. So it's kind of like a nice, extensive, more relaxed conversation than what we have on stage, which is
right.
3 or 4 guests. Our next show in New York is coming up at QED in Astoria on April 12th at 9 p.m., which is a great space, by the way, if anyone's listening and you haven't been. It's an intimate room. The acoustics are beautiful. It's a really good vibe. It's a good place to go to open mics, QED. And then we have a show May 7th in L.A. at Meltdown Comics.
Oh, nice.
So that's... And we are in process of putting together a treatment to adapt The Bitch Seat for TV.
And so could you just explain to people, like, what a treatment is? Like, what that means?
Well, I'm learning myself. it's basically a written document that lays out exactly how you envision the show to be. Like, you know, all the steps from the beginning of the end to the show, what it would look like, the multimedia, the segments that you would include, you know, the technical specs. But it's new territory for me. I don't know if it would translate to TV, but I kind of just want to be on TV, and this is the vehicle that I have right now.
Yeah,
I would probably have to figure out a budget, and then we'd pitch it to various production companies see who could help us.
Okay. Sell it.
Yeah.
It's so cool that little Lissa, like, wrote all this material for you. Like, that's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
I know.
How much you journaled. That's amazing.
Dude, I thank her every day. I had this moment, this zen moment on the train where I was like, wow, I'm doing above and beyond what 13-year-old Lissa thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because 13-year-old Lissa wanted to be in New York real bad. Wanted to be editor-in-chief of The New Yorker, specifically.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, it's weird to go from a place of longing for something and dreaming about something and anticipating, which is what I spent the first 30 years of my life doing, and to now be, like, doing it, like, with the real people. It's incredible.
That's cool. Do you still journal?
I do, but not as much as I used to, because mm-hmm. my journals were my friends, and I would confide in them, but now I just, like, confide in anybody who will listen. You can find out all the updates and the latest shows at my website, actually, lissamandel.com, lissamandel.com/the-bitch-seat. Bitch Seat has its own page on Facebook. The Bitch Seat is also on Twitter, the_bitch_seat, but most of the stuff I put out through my own thing. So on Twitter, I'm Lissa is a person. On Instagram, I am a flock of sandwiches.
Yeah, so it's this great book. It's called The Writing Diet, and it talks about how she had been teaching the artist's way in class, and then she was noticing that the people in the class who were sort of, like, overweight or out of shape or whatever by the end of the class had actually gotten in better health.
Wow.
She, in The Writing Diet, talks about how getting all of this, like, emotional baggage out and just, like, writing down, like, basically journaling every day helps you deal with just your issues, obviously. And so it was making people healthier. You know, she talks about, like, the morning pages, which is the same thing in the artist's way. And I think it's a more therapeutic approach. Rather than just, like, you know, don't eat carbs.
No, this is, like, all about that.
So I would recommend it. It's The Writing Diet. And what's her name again?
Julia Cameron. If you haven't read the Eckhart Tolle books, The Power of Now and A New Earth, specifically the second one, which I actually read first, they are about creating space within yourself in order to be an open channel for your thoughts and feelings to flow through. So I actually have a white tattoo on the inside of my left arm that says permission, which comes from the movement technique that I studied, the Lloyd Williamson movement technique, which is about making your body an open and vulnerable vessel for things to flow through. And I found that the Eckhart Tolle books were dovetailed really nicely with that, because they talk about having permission to have your feelings, because if you don't, if they get blocked or repressed inside of you, they're not gone. They're not gone until you purge them out or until you let them flow out of you, which is also why The Artist's Way and The Morning Pages are so crucial, because you have to unstop that cork or it could explode at any time.
Yeah, well, sometimes you don't even know that you have these things bottled up until you just start writing about nothing, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I had these feelings.
Yes, exactly.
James Baldwin's Notes of a Native Son, he's writing this forward 30 years after he published all these essays from his youth, and he's talking about how the struggle is the same. Yeah, it's really interesting that the struggle is continual. And it doesn't go anywhere. He just has a new perspective on it.
It is. And, you know, I'm always looking at the past through rose-colored glasses. And, even in my journals when I was 13, I would write about my previous journals and how I used to be a better writer. And it never stops. Like, even last night I was thinking, 3 years ago I was so much more prolific. I was so much more blah, 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 blah. But I was always unhappy. Mm-hmm. You know? We find new ways to be unhappy.
And I feel like I'm always saying, like, God, when did I get so dumb? Like, I feel like I'm getting dumber and dumber every year.
Well, for me, it's the weed.
Yeah.
On that note, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
So lovely. And everyone go check out The Bitch Seat immediately. The music you've been listening to is All That Glitters from the album Days and Nights by Sweet Soubrette.
Subscribe to us on iTunes and write us a review. We'll love you forever. You should like us on Facebook, and you should send us an email at
actorhackpodcast@gmail.com. So thank you everyone for listening, and bye.
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 If anything, my mother will listen to it.